Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am your host for this hour, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening in. It is April showers again today with chances of thunderstorms, especially in the evening and tonight. Temperatures will be around 37, and it won't warm up until next week. Rain is likely to continue on Saturday and Sunday night, and Saturday night as well, and possible snow is being predicted for Saturday and Sunday night. Yikes. On Monday, the sun is expected to return with a high around 46, but at night it could go again below freezing. After that, next week's temperatures are expected to be in the 50s, and we should see some sun. We're all looking forward to that. And it's Friday, so here is municipal reporter Dennis Hart with a roundup of this past week's news from the pages of the Ames Tribune and local papers. Take it away, Dennis.
Let's begin with a look at Tuesday's Ames Tribune, which reported that Danfoss was fined more than $12,000 by Iowa workplace safety regulators after an employee died on the job in January. The Denmark-based company, which has two locations in Ames that primarily produce hydraulic transport components, was ordered to pay the fine for having machine guards that offered the chance of an accident and for not listing the objects that caused a work-related illness or injury for a handful of events on its safety log. This after an employee, 45-year-old John Lavery, died in January when a safety hood dropped onto his head while he was working at a motor test stand at the company's 13th Street plant. A company spokesman said prompt corrective actions were taken. Lavery's widow said the amount of the fine made her, in her words, sick at my stomach, and said it would not make enough of an impact on the company's bottom line to make it reform its safety program. Danfoss employs more than 1,000 people at its Ames locations. Also Tuesday in the Tribune, the Ames School Board unanimously approved a resolution on Monday night aimed at Republican Governor Kim Reynolds and the Iowa State Legislature. That resolution opposed pending reductions to statewide backfill payments that could cut about $1.3 million from the school district's operating budget for the 2018-2019 school year. 5 years ago, the legislature reduced commercial property taxes, which significantly cut income to Iowa's cities, counties, and school districts. The money lost through commercial property taxes has since been replaced on a yearly basis with state dollars, also known as backfill payments. But this year, work is being done to phase out those payments, beginning July 1st. While nothing official has been decided, Ames School Board member Lewis Rosser said Monday that the district estimates it might lose $1.3 million to budget cuts this upcoming school year. Most of that money would have to come from the district's general fund, which pays for teacher salaries and student programs. If the plan to reduce the backfill is approved, school district property taxes might have to go up to replace the deficit created by the backfill payment reductions. Tuesday's Trib also reported that an Ames man was arrested Monday after he allegedly threatened to kill his then-girlfriend and assaulted her multiple times. 28-year-old Robert Paul Kimbrough was charged, among other things, with harassment, domestic assault, assault on a peace officer, and probation violation. His preliminary hearing has been scheduled for April 19th. Also on the crime beat, the Boone man involved in a robbery last year with his older brother was sentenced to 50 years in prison on Monday. 19-year-old Ian Lester had pleaded guilty to burglary, robbery, theft, and criminal mischief. Court documents allege that Lester and his 23-year-old brother Edward forcefully entered a home in the 4100 block of Ontario Street last July, pushed the victim to the ground, and took numerous items. Edward Lester was also sentenced to 50 years in prison in February. Also Tuesday, the Tribune reported that Ames Chamber of Commerce representatives were left wondering what happened to the See Yourself in Ames Psy statue on Main Street, which was found with its left arm broken off and sitting next to it on Monday. Main Street Cultural District Executive Director Cindy Hicks said no one at the chamber knew anything about the incident, but she said because the arm was left next to the statue, she does not believe it was an act of vandalism. She said lots of people try to take pictures with the statues, and there have been incidents of children sitting or hanging on the arm. Tuesday's Trib also had word that a Democratic congressman from Maryland joined other Democrats on Monday in an effort to elect Tracy Freese to the Iowa Senate. Freese was running in a special election on Tuesday to replace former Senate Majority Leader Bill Dix, who resigned in March after video footage showed him kissing a female lobbyist in a Des Moines bar. Maryland Congressman John Delaney went to Nevada to knock on doors for Freese and also stopped at the Ames office of 4th District Congressional candidate J.D. Scholten. Delaney is running for the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination. And the results of that election made front page news in Wednesday's Tribune. And the news was that Republican Annette Sweeney from Alden won that special election against Democrat Tracy Freese by about 1,000 votes. Sweeney is a former member of the Iowa House of Representatives and former State Director of Rural Development for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She received 4,742 votes, compared to 3,726 for Freese. Sweeney won in Butler, Grundy, and Hardin counties, while Freese won in Story County. Iowa Republican Governor Kim Reynolds called Sweeney's victory well-deserved and said, in her words, "She has spent her life working on behalf of rural communities, and I look forward to her joining the state Senate and partnering with our team to build a better Iowa." During the campaign, Sweeney said she wants to promote education and advocate for farmers in the state house. She will have to defend her new seat almost immediately and compete again for a full 4-year term in November. Her first step, defeating Republican challenger Chad Buss in the June 5th primary. Wednesday's Tribune also brought news of Tuesday night's Ames City Council meeting, where, once again, as it has been for so many weeks and months, the main topic was Ames' rental control issues. And that issue made for a crowded council chamber as a large audience watched the council narrow the scope of its proposed cap on the percentage of rental properties in certain neighborhoods. After 4 hours or so, the council voted to apply that rental cap only to 4 neighborhoods near the Iowa State campus instead of 8. Tuesday night's meeting was so crowded that some of the audience had to watch a live stream of the meeting in a nearby conference room in order to comply with City Hall's fire code. The crowd was made up of homeowners, real estate agents, property managers, and neighborhood residents, and nearly 36 of them spoke up about the potential 25% rental cap on neighborhoods near campus. About half the speakers spoke in favor of the cap. The other half told the council it should let the free market decide who buys houses and whether they decide to rent them out or live in them. After the long discussion, the council decided to move forward with a cap on the north part of the South Campus area neighborhood, as well as on the Colonial Village neighborhood, the College Creek Old Ames Middle School neighborhood, and the Oak Riverside neighborhood. Each of these neighborhoods already surpasses the 25% cap, so the restriction would do little other than to prevent additional properties from getting rental permits. Tuesday night's action was not the final word on this. The council still must approve an ordinance at a later date. While the council concentrated on the rental ordinance Tuesday night, the focus of Tuesday's Story County Board of Supervisors meeting was on the proposed Healthy Life Center project in Ames. And the main question the supervisors faced was, how can the county pay its proposed share of the center's construction and operating costs? The proposed center is estimated to cost nearly $49 million, and Story County is expected to pay $3 million of that for construction and $200,000 each year in operating costs. The supervisors did not take any action or commit any dollars on Tuesday, but they talked about it a lot. Chairman Rick Sanders said the funding questions could be answered later. Supervisor Loris Olson expressed concerns about how the county could afford the project, given other projects and challenges on the horizon. Supervisor Martin Chitty agreed the county faces some financial burdens down the road, but he said, so do the other entities involved with the proposed center. Under the current plan, Story County would join forces with the City of Ames, Mary Greeley Medical Center, and Heartland Senior Services in funding the center. In addition, $18 million would have to be raised in a private fundraising effort. There was more, much more, in Wednesday's Tribune, including word that the Ames School Board has approved a contract to build a new set of high school tennis courts. The board's action came 1 week after voters approved a $110 million bond issue to help build a new Ames High School and to add classrooms to the Mitchell, Meeker, and Edwards Elementary Schools. The new tennis courts will be built on the district's 24th Street site near the district offices. Earlier, Hala Architecture had been selected to provide design services for the project, and the board has now decided to award the nearly $1.5 million contract to build it to Harold Pike Construction of Ames. Construction is expected to be finished in time for the spring 2019 tennis season. Demolition of the existing courts will take place after the new courts are completed. The school board has also moved closer to finding a replacement for retiring superintendent Tim Taylor. Last week, the board met in closed session to interview a first round of candidates for the job. This week, members planned to interview the top 5 finalists. The goal is to identify 2 finalists to bring into the community next Tuesday and Wednesday for focus groups and for public forums at 5:15 at the district office. Crime also made news in Wednesday's Tribune with word that an armed robbery took place Tuesday at Maxwell State Bank on Main Street. 2 men entered the bank Tuesday morning. They displayed handguns, ordered employees to the floor, took an undisclosed amount of cash, and fled in a vehicle. That vehicle was found unoccupied a short time later at Maxwell City Park. No injuries were reported in the incident. Both the Story County Sheriff's Office and the FBI are investigating. One more note from Wednesday's Tribune. Iowa State University has taken the next step toward creating a mobile version of the university's iconic campanile structure. The first bell necessary for creating a scaled-down version of the campanile was cast inside the Black Engineering Building on campus. The finished product will be 20 feet tall and weigh between 2,400 and 3,000 pounds. It will have three detachable sections that will let visitors get an up-close look at the bells inside and how the whole thing works. This smaller version of the Campanile will be able to travel to university events, graduation ceremonies, sporting events, the Iowa State Fair, the Story County Fair, and to numerous other locations. The cost of the project is estimated at $210,000. In Thursday's Tribune, word that the state of Iowa will pay just under $600,000 in attorney's fees to two former Iowa State University students after the school refused to let them use a copyright image of Psy next to a marijuana leaf for a T-shirt. The former students were involved in a marijuana legalization advocacy group. 4 years ago, that group was granted use of ISU's Psy logos for T-shirts, where Psy's head was next to a marijuana leaf. ISU administrators later rescinded approval of the design after the shirt gained attention from the media. Also Thursday, the Tribune reported that the Property and Facilities Committee of the Iowa Board of Regents had given initial approval for naming the university's new $5 million poultry science farm after those who are making it possible. During the Regents' meeting in Council Bluffs on Wednesday, the committee recommended the facility be called the Robert T. Hamilton Poultry and Teaching Farm. That naming request is in honor of Hamilton, who is now deceased, and whose surviving spouse committed $3 million to help fund construction of the farm project. The new poultry farm includes demolition of nine existing 1960s buildings and construction of six new state-of-the-art teaching and research facilities, and at least three new storage facilities. Thursday's Tribune also reported that the Ames City Council has once again gone on record in support of the proposed Healthy Life Center project. The council voted unanimously to instruct staff to keep working on the proposal. Under current plans, the city would own and operate the nearly $49 million facility, and the council would have to submit a $15 million bond referendum to voters to fund its share of building it. In addition, the city of Ames would pay more than $400,000 in yearly operating costs for the Healthy Life Center. Also Thursday in the Tribune, a story about the community of Ziering in northeast Story County. It will receive $100,000 from the state of Iowa to renovate an historic building on the city's Main Street. The city has owned the building at 108 West Main for 2 years, following a court-ordered sale. Plans are in the works for a complete rehab of the building's facade, and the interior will be remodeled so the ground level can be occupied by businesses and the second floor can be used for apartments. The structure was built in 1905, and it once housed the Security State Bank, a barbershop, and apartments. In this week's Nevada Journal, word that the Nevada Economic Development Council completed its search for a new executive director by contracting with the Ames Economic Development Commission. John Hall, who is a Nevada resident and who works with the Ames Commission, has assumed the duties of executive director for Nevada. Also in the journal feature stories about Story City Mayor Mike Jensen, who has served as mayor since 2010, and about Roland Mayor Andy Webb, who moved to the community 6 years ago, was elected to the city council shortly afterward, and became mayor last year. And there's word that Nevada High School Agriculture Education instructor Kevin Cooper has received the Stephen L. Fales Conservation Award, which is given in recognition of land stewardship. Cooper has used cover crops to improve both soil and water quality on farmland. In this week's Boone News Republican, word that the Boone Community School District Board meeting had an emotional start on Monday. Parents who have children at Franklin Elementary School and staff members used the public comment session at the meeting to express their concerns and fears and disappointment at the departure of former Franklin principal Trish Carlson. The board members expressed their understanding but said they were not allowed to talk about personnel issues at a public meeting. There are about 45 applicants for the Franklin position. At the recent Boone County Board of Supervisors meeting, the board denied requests by the County Historical Society to release $4,500 in budgeted money and an additional $2,500 to help pay for repair work that needs to be done to the Mamie Dowd Eisenhower birthplace. The board did authorize Boone County Landfill to buy a mobile recycling trailer for between $5,000 and $7,500. Also in the News Republican, the Boone County Courthouse is celebrating its first 100 years. The courthouse was dedicated on May 1, 1918, when the U.S. had just entered World War I. Veterans from the Civil War, which ended in 1865, were on hand for that 1918 Boone Courthouse dedication. Now the Masons Grand Lodge of Iowa is set to rededicate the cornerstone laid at the courthouse. The ceremony will take place at 1 p.m. on May 4th, outside the north side of the building. In this week's Story City Herald, word that the Roland Story School Board approved the budget for the 2019 fiscal year, and the result is a drop in the district's anticipated tax rate to $13.87 per $1,000 valuation. That's a decrease of 40 cents from this fiscal year's tax rate. What made the tax cut possible was an increase in the taxable valuation for the school district as a whole. The Herald also reported that Story City recently received a Tree City USA Growth Award. That award is made to communities that have made a commitment to the management of public trees. Story City was one of 18 communities to qualify for Tree City USA growth recognition. Cities that receive it must provide education, planning, and management, along with tree planting and maintenance. Also in this week's Herald, as well as in the Boone News Republican and the Nevada Journal, a long story about the state of Iowa's mental health system. It's written by a reporter for Gatehouse Media, which owns all three newspapers and the Ames Tribune. The story looks at what happens to the mentally ill in Iowa. There are about 132,000 people in the state who have mental illness and only 760 staffed acute care beds statewide. Nearly half of all inmates in county jails have mental illness. It's a compelling read, and you can find it in any of the newspapers we cover in our weekly overview right here. And that is your summary of this week's news events from the pages of the Ames Tribune and other nearby newspapers. I'm KHOI Civic Reporter Dennis Hart, wishing you, as always, a happy, safe, and healthy weekend.
If you've just joined us, this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio with more warm weather music from Vivaldi. I'm your host for the hour, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you, Dennis Hart, for a rundown of local news. Last Tuesday, Senate File 481 was signed into law by Governor Reynolds. In February, Governor Reynolds stated in a fundraising letter that the effort behind this law sent a message to, quote, far-left liberals in Des Moines and Iowa City who've been considering moves to delay or deter deportation for people in the country illegally, unquote. The law, which goes into effect on July 1st, is commonly known as the law banning sanctuary cities. We contacted Governor Kim Reynolds' office to ask why she signed the bill into law, and her office provided this statement. Governor Reynolds is strongly opposed to any city or community in Iowa becoming a sanctuary city for illegal immigrants who have chosen to commit a crime. This law will simply require our local jurisdictions to work with immigration officials when dealing with illegal immigrants who have knowingly broken the law, unquote. A sanctuary city is not a legal term, but a general description for local jurisdictions with some kind of policy that limits cooperation with federal immigration efforts. Other states with laws that in some form prohibit so-called sanctuary cities include Georgia, North Carolina, Alabama, Tennessee, Indiana, Mississippi, and Texas, and other states are also considering doing this. According to the Des Moines Register, supporters of the law say it will maintain public safety and uphold the rule of law, while critics argue that the new law is an anti-immigration law that will stoke racial fears and could fuel discrimination and cast a pall of fear. So what exactly is in this bill and exactly how will it change things? I wanted to know and to be able to sort it out, so I called numerous public officials, and almost none of them wanted to speak on record about this at this point. It was very hard to even get people to answer my call. Tom Ferguson, executive director of the Iowa County Attorneys Association, which represents the county attorneys of Iowa, did agree to explain what the law actually does. Ferguson was county attorney of Blackhawk County for 25 years prior to his position at the Iowa County Attorneys Association. He started out with a rundown of the provisions that are stated in Senate File 481, which does now add a new code section.
Basically, Senate File 481 adds a new code section, Iowa Chapter 825, to the code, which places restrictions on local government impediments to immigration and enforcement. Now, the main features of this legislation requires local cooperation with federal immigration on detainer requests. It adopts procedures to transfer custody of state and local prisoners to federal immigration authorities prior to the end of their sentences. It prohibits local government policies against investigation of immigration status of detainees and arrestees. It prohibits policies barring cooperation with federal immigration officers or restricting their access to jail and detention facilities. It requires state and local agencies to put all immigration enforcement policies in writing and update them to comply with this new chapter. It bars consideration of race, skin color, language, or national origin in immigration enforcement. It limits collecting national origin information from crime victims, witnesses, or those reporting crimes to situations where it's pertinent to the investigation. It creates a complaint process alleging violations of the chapter to be reviewed by the Iowa Attorney General's Office. It empowers the Attorney General's Office to file a civil action for ongoing intentional violations of the chapter on founded complaints and provides loss of all state funding if a violation is found for a period of 90 days or 3 months. And it provides for reinstatement of state funding by declaratory action showing that entity that it was shown to have been violating it is now complying with Chapter 825. So that's basically the highlights and summary, in summary fashion, an overview of the code chapter.
Where does the county attorney come into this?
Well, I suppose the county attorney comes into this because the county attorney is the chief law enforcement officer of each county to begin with. Secondly, we advise all the elected officials. So they generally look, Board of Supervisors, the sheriff, look to us for guidance on statutes and the law. It also requires that counties have policies as they relate to this. And so consequently, county attorneys are going to have to work with whatever their elected officials are that we're going to have policies to make sure they have a policy, a written policy that complies with this chapter. That's part of the directive here.
That's a lot to unpack for a layperson like me who is relatively unfamiliar with enforcement protocol. So in trying to sort it out, I asked Tom Ferguson to explain the law's overarching purpose. Does the law change anything that is currently existing to date? Are there any sanctuary cities in Iowa?
As far as I know, there's no sanctuary cities or counties or communities in the state. They don't entitle it a sanctuary city bill. That may be something that may have been in somebody's intent when they provided for this legislation. But the caption to this bill is an act relating to the enforcement of immigration laws. It really talks about placing restrictions on government in complying or cooperating with immigration authorities.
If you've just joined us, that's Tom Ferguson. He's the executive director of the Iowa County Attorneys Association, and he's explaining the new Iowa code signed into law, known as the Law Forbidding Sanctuary Cities. The law's chief goal is to prohibit local restrictions on compliance with immigration authorities, otherwise known as ICE authorities. Therefore, I asked if there actually had been a problem in Iowa with noncompliance with immigration officials to date. Does it change what law enforcement officials and county attorneys have to do?
I don't know that it substantially changes it. I believe most, if not all, jurisdictions complied with and cooperated with ICE authorities that I'm aware of in the state. I think law enforcement has historically cooperated and will cooperate in the future as they have in the past.
And what does cooperation actually mean?
If someone would have been indicated or ICE or DHS thought this person was a cartel member or somebody that had committed heinous crimes outside this country and the person was going to be released, but ICE needed a little bit more time to make sure they could come and pick the person up. For the most part, I think that this cooperation was ongoing and existing, and I don't see a major change in that. I believe most law enforcement personnel would cooperate with them to make sure that they didn't release somebody dangerous back on the streets.
Most public officials that I spoke with, off the record as well, reiterated that But at this point, I learned an important distinction. An often expressed fear in the wake of Senate File 41 turning into law has been that local enforcement will be forced to help ICE actively find and deport undocumented immigrants. In fact, this new law is limited only to criminal incidents, as you hear Ferguson explain. It applies specifically to protocols once a suspect has been arrested or brought in for some criminal suspicion. According to Ferguson and all of the other public officials I spoke with, so far, Iowa enforcement has been cooperating with ICE in criminal cases and informing ICE when there's a person who they think ICE may want to investigate. Given the current actions of local enforcement in Iowa, this law comes off more as a change in perception than actual changes in local law enforcement behavior and protocol. By the way, being an undocumented immigrant is not a criminal offense. Being deported and returning to the U.S. is a criminal offense, and of course, other criminal acts are also possible. According to Ferguson and other public official I spoke to, it seemed like the most significant change with this law is centered around the issue of something called detainer requests. Federal immigration officials can request that local officials hold someone for up to 48 hours past the usual time a suspect can be detained. So I asked Ferguson to explain this.
This statute applies to individuals that are arrested or in police custody for public offenses. It was written in such a way that the intent, I believe, is that individuals have had to come in contact with local authorities for a public offense and are now either in detention, custody, or under arrest for a state charge. So the individuals that we're talking about here have to be arrested in custody or detention before this statute comes into play. And then they cooperate with ICE from there. The only change really is dealing with this 48-hour request to detain somebody, or up to 48-hour request, and cooperating with ICE in that regard. But I think most jurisdictions would notify ICE, tell them that the person is in custody, they would tell them when the person is going to be released, if they knew, and they would work with ICE to make sure that ICE was aware that they might be releasing this person so they could come and get them. So I don't think none of that changes.
Again, there was a sense that not that much changes in terms of police protocol. However, it was pointed out that under the law, if any I-1 believes that a local agency is not complying and is letting people go, he or she can complain with evidence, and then a district court can determine that the law has been violated and funds can be denied the city for a certain amount of time. Also, there is a clause in there which allows for an appeal. Ferguson also raised another issue of liability for local enforcement that is related to constitutional rights.
The issue really becomes as to whether or not there's some legal authority to hold that individual for up to 48 hours for ICE authorities to pick that person up when they're going to be released. I think the one area that was problematic for people based upon some court decisions was whether or not they could hold that person up to 48 hours after that person would have been normally released absent a court order. And so I think that was problematic for some counties. Now, this statute does require that the ICE documentation be in writing and also accompanied by administrative orders of detention or deportation or warrant. So there is some language written into this statute that provides for maybe additional documentation from the feds that show that there is, at least administratively, some proceeding for their deportation or warrant for arrest. That being said, it is not a judicial court order. It is an administrative order provided by Homeland Security or ICE officials. There's still a question, maybe not under federal law in our circuit, but under state law, as to whether or not there would be potential liability if you held them after their period of time for release had expired.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time.
And you're welcome.
As I understand it, you're still reviewing the bill yourself, or the law yourself, to understand exactly what it's going to mean to you.
Right. We're still in the process. So that was just a quick overview of the statute as we see it, but There are many different provisions in it, and we're still in the process of analyzing it and coming to some sort of understanding of what it really means and how it will really affect counties and county attorneys. Obviously, with any new statute, there are some questions in it and its application and the processes employed. I think that there'll be more than likely potential litigation in several areas of this statute. I don't know whether some county may or may not challenge the statute for imposing obligations on them that they feel should be enforced by federal authorities, or it could be an individual that has been affected by this statute may sue to litigate issues as to whether or not its application to them.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
You bet. No problem.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
The liability that Ferguson refers to is the violation of the Fourth Amendment right to not be detained stated in the Constitution. The Iowa Civil Liberties Union has responded to this issue of the Fourth Amendment with a statement that I'll share with you in a minute. One potential scenario a law official described to me was that possibly somebody's identity could be mistaken, which would make local law enforcement legally liable for illegal detention. Ferguson also pointed out that the order, so to speak, given by immigrations to detain someone is in the form of a request, not a court order with evidence showing probable cause for detention. Some sheriffs say that that law is confusing and they need more evidence to hold people, although the new law says they should comply. Rita Bettis of the Iowa Civil Liberties Union made this statement in response to the Fourth Amendment issue. Quote, "It violates a person's constitutional rights for Iowa law enforcement to hold them without a warrant or probable cause of a crime, but that is what ICE detainer requests ask Iowa law enforcement to do. That's because ICE detainer requests are exactly that, an ask of local law enforcement to hold a person without a warrant or probable cause. As a result of this, we are deeply concerned about the passage of SF 481. And will strive to defend the constitutional rights of Iowans against unlawful detentions. Because detainers aren't warrants, which require law enforcement to go in front of a neutral magistrate to make their case, they just aren't reliable indicators of a person's immigration status. Holding a person in jail beyond the time authorized by the law, i.e. after the person posts bail, is released on his or her own recognizance, completes a sentence, or is acquitted, is a new arrest and must be authorized by a judicial warrant or independent probable cause of a crime. And a detainer request issued by ICE simply isn't either or those. This is still a statement from the Iowa Civil Liberties Union. Listening to the debate about this bill was truly disturbing and disheartening. Our Constitution protects citizens and immigrants alike, including undocumented immigrants. But even if the legislators who voted for it care about the constitutional rights only of U.S. citizens in Iowa or those who are lawfully present, it's important to note that SF 481 is written so poorly that even they aren't excluded from the bill's reach. It's important to note that the bill does not go into effect until July 1st. We are currently considering all our options to combat this harmful bill," unquote. And that was a statement from the Iowa Civil Liberties Union, so we may be seeing them filing a suit against aspects of the new law. I hope this little tutorial has been helpful in understanding the new law a little bit more, and no doubt we'll see the implications play out during the next year. Usually I try to get more direct interviews with people explaining things in their own words, but in investigating this, it was remarkable how few people would allow themselves to go on record yet to respond to this bill. This is Local Talk. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for this morning. Let's take a music break, and we'll be back in a minute. Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today. Thank you for being here. Mary Rankin is here. She's with the ISU and Ames Sustainable Director, and she's here for a monthly check-in with Local Talk. Welcome back, Mary.
Thank you. Good morning.
And you brought some people with you.
I do have some people with me. I'm so excited to have with me this morning Amy Yocum from Storey County Conservation. She is a natural resource specialist there. And also Marlene Ayersman, who is the director and founder of the Iowa Wildlife Center that we have here in our area. And we wanted to talk about something that is a challenge and is a decision oftentimes for folks this time of the year. We have a lot of folks graduating, and we also have a lot of people leaving Ames for various reasons. And sometimes when you leave a community, if you're a pet owner, a pet isn't necessarily something that you're easily able to take with you.
A new angle of recycling.
Absolutely. I would say reuse. Right, because these pets stay in their current form, mm-hmm. and they continue to live on through the initiative that we want to talk about. And we can be out hiking, be out in the outdoors. We see fish. We see, you know, snakes. We see other types of wildlife. And sometimes pet owners think, oh, wouldn't that be a wonderful life for my pet to lead without me necessarily being the owner as I'm leaving town?
Set them free.
Let them roam through grasses and roll in the leaves and, you know, all those sorts of things. And yet we want to make sure that the wonderful home that pet owners gave their pets and the wonderful care and consideration that did include the outdoors, maybe not necessarily all the time, is allowed to happen through another home. So a rehoming option, if you will, another R
rehoming.
That we can add. Rehoming,
right.
Yes. Okay. While it's not necessarily a really complicated consideration, it is something that we want to ensure that people have awareness about and also just resources.
Mm-hmm.
And so I might turn it over to Amy to talk a little bit about what Storey County has, witnessed and seen and experienced and had to, you know, sort of address.
Okay.
And Amy is with Storey County Conservation.
Right, correct.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for having me here today.
Thanks for being here.
This started a couple of years ago when we discovered some aquatic invasive plants in water bodies around the county. We discovered a plant called European water clover in the lake at McFarland Park, and then in West Ames in a retention pond recently, we discovered Brazilian waterweed or Brazilian alodia.
Hmm.
And most likely these plants came from a fish tank being dumped.
Hmm.
And, you know, unfortunately when that happens, we have to go in and control those aquatic plants. And no one wants to have to put chemicals into a water body to control those.
Which can affect other life in that water body,
yes.
Obviously. Right.
Yes. And so, you know, I work closely with the Aquatic Invasive Species Coordinator with the DNR to try to find solutions to take care of those problems. And we really think that we're missing this opportunity to give people an alternative,
mm-hmm.
to releasing, you know, whether it's a snake or dumping a fish tank or a turtle, you know, those animals you think might naturally go back to the wild is not necessarily a good thing. So we're trying to provide opportunities other than releasing back into the wild.
Of course. And I think a lot of folks, if they think about, for example, going to the animal shelter, right, you're looking for puppies and kitties. But there's so many other pets that folks have that also can have an opportunity to be adopted. And we want to make sure that folks look into those opportunities and let those pets have a wonderful home with someone else as well.
Yes, for
Amy,
sure.
Amy, do you, in your work, do you find animals that have been released into the wild?
We do occasionally have things show up that shouldn't be out in Iowa's wild.
Mm-hmm.
You know, more often we're talking, you know, plant species that become invasive, whether mm-hmm. they're, you know, released by escaping from your yard or through something like a fish tank dump.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I know we had we have a collective group, and I'm so honored to be a part of that discussion that's been discussing this particular initiative. And we had an individual, you'll have to remind me of her name, from Story County Animal Control. And she had mentioned finding, you could tell, pet rats around. If you guys remember that discussion. So there are those things. You might obviously see rats in the wild, but spotted rats, probably not. And so, you know, they went to check on that and certainly found that someone had released pet rats. They've also had different species, iguanas and a bearded dragon recently.
Yeah, I think maybe a python too.
Right, wow. That was brought to them to be able to, you know, find a new home. So
And people do abandon dogs.
Absolutely. Dogs and kittens thinking, oh, someone will pick them up. And, well, that might happen, but way too often I think it doesn't. If you consider if suddenly we were taken out of our home and just sort of released, we think of how really petrifying that experience would be, and to think of an animal that depends upon us for so much. It certainly is not a good experience.
One thing that we get at the Iowa Wildlife Center are opportunities to take in some of these animals, because people do find their way to us and think that we'll be able to take in box turtles or snapping turtles, or when they find snapping turtles, little baby quarter-sized snapping turtles, you know, they think they're so cute.
Not so cute when they grow up.
They keep them for the summer and realize that they're a lot of work. They're an aquatic species, and you have to have filters and special, you know, you have to have turtle food, and you have to clean the tank, and oh my gosh, snapping turtles can have a lot of waste to them as they grow up and get to be 20-pound snapping turtles like the one we have in our office right now.
So, is it actually legal to take a snapping turtle?
You can if you have a fishing license in the state. You're allowed to take so many snapping turtles or painted turtles. As long as you have a fishing license, you can take them out of the wild and keep them. But people find within months, so a few months or even less than that it's not a good idea and it's not as easy as they think. And kids get tired of them. They're not like playing with a puppy or a kitten.
A snapping turtle.
People can come to
people. They don't cuddle so well.
They do not. Right. Although Beak is very our snapper is. People could come and see him in some of our programs, and he's quite engaging. But he's still a snapping turtle.
Yeah, in his own way.
Yeah.
So is this? Are you looking to have this snapping turtle adopted out?
No, we aren't.
He's yours.
And he is on our education permit now. And what happens is the Department of Natural Resources, when we get the native species in that have been in captivity for a period of time and we don't know where they came from, the DNR does not want us to release those native species back into the wild because of the potential of them passing on any diseases that they may, any bacterial diseases or anything that they may have come down with while in captivity. And many of them do come to us sick. You know, that's the other problem. People don't necessarily think about veterinary costs that go along with things like turtles and snakes and some of these and fish. You know, fish get ick. They get bacterial and fungal diseases and things that require medicine. So people don't often think about that. And when faced with that, that's the other thing. They go, I can't afford it. I can't do it. You know, and so then they might release those sick animals into the wild, which then they pass on that to wild populations. So the DNR doesn't want us to release wild, native wild species where we don't know where they've come from or they've been in captivity too long. So then we're faced with, do we keep them in our education programs, whether it's the County Conservation Board or our program, or do we euthanize them or find other homes for them? So when they're non-native, that's the whole other side of it. And we've gotten both native box turtles, like Ornate, the endangered Ornate box turtle. But we've also gotten eastern box turtles and three-toed box turtles that people can legally buy in pet stores in Iowa. And they think that they're doing them, like Mary was talking about, a kindness by releasing them to the wild, giving them their freedom. But they didn't evolve here. You know, these animals have to put up with Iowa's winters, and they did not evolve with Iowa's winters. And so they're not doing them a kindness, and they're often committing them to a kind of a brutal death sentence. So, yeah.
So what we are looking to do and what our goal is and what our initiative is about is increasing awareness and education about the fact that there are options. There are many resources in our community, and we would encourage anyone that finds that they may not be able to take a pet with them, or it's not the best decision as they may move to another community, as they may move to a new job that's going to have them very, very busy, to reach out and ask different resources for different options. And one of the primary resources in our community, we have a wonderful animal shelter through the Ames Animal Shelter. Story County also has an animal shelter. And I have worked with those folks personally, both on adopting and assisting others for options for rehoming. And they're just wonderful folks. And they have their top consideration being trying to find homes, rehome pets into, you know, wonderful, loving homes so that they continue to have long lives. So it's just, well, I said before, it's fairly simple, the whole idea. It's not really complicated. I think when the time comes and when folks are busy and so many things are happening, it sort of appears to be a bit of a conundrum. And so we're just saying, take some time, contact the Ames Animal Shelter, contact Story County Conservation, contact the Iowa Wildlife Center. Folks are very welcome to call me, and I'm happy to get them to, you know, the resources to ensure that those pets have a, you know, very long, happy life with a new owner.
Okay, so let's run down those options again. We've got Story County Conservation, mm-hmm. Ames, Iowa Wildlife Shelter.
Mm-hmm. Center.
Iowa Wildlife Center.
Iowa Wildlife Center. Sorry. And then we've got the Story County Animal Shelter and the Ames Animal Shelter.
Correct.
And presumably Boone County has an animal shelter too, I would guess.
Yes, I believe they do.
Mm-hmm.
We have not contacted them as part of our initiative.
Mm-hmm.
We're just trying to work around the local Ames area.
Uh-huh. Right.
But definitely that's someone that you could contact.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because we reach much farther than Story County. It, probably every county has its own animal shelter.
Most definitely. A connection mm-hmm. Related to animals that folks may find that shouldn't be roaming around or don't have mm-hmm. tags related to them, so you know where to return them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we'll put a rundown of that on our website, too, khoyfm.org. And Mary, you can be reached how?
I can be reached. My email is mrankin, R-A-N-K-I-N, at iastate.edu. Folks are also welcome to call me on my office phone, 515-294-5052. I would also say that we will be talking, I'm sure, when Susan Guiazda is on, about Rummage Rampage coming up this summer.
Mm-hmm.
We are going, as a part of Rummage Rampage this year, mm-hmm. we are going to offer that if folks have pets
oh,
that
wow.
they are not able to take with them, that we will have the facilities there to be able to take those pets in and then get them out to the agencies that can assist in rehoming them.
So that's new.
That is brand new this year.
So Rummage Rampage will have a pet store angle to it.
Now, we're not going to look at rehoming them at Rummage Rampage. We are just going to be
accepting them in.
We want to get them out to the different agencies, make sure they're healthy, make sure that, you know, we are getting them to, you know, with the proper care they may need,
mm-hmm.
and then ensure that we're vetting proper homes. You can come to Rummage Rampage and think a chair is really, really cute and take it home, and maybe it's not the best for you, but we don't want that to happen
with
a pet. Right, exactly. It's a little easier.
Don't plan to go home with a snapping turtle.
Yes, yeah. Don't plan to do that at Rummage Rampage, but please, it's no questions asked, and we're very happy to be able to assist you
okay.
in rehoming your pets at Rummage Rampage.
So
yes.
if you need to give up a pet,
yes.
you can bring it to Rummage Rampage in a
right.
cage, presumably. You have to provide some sort of container.
Yes, it would help. And you guys can talk on that. But, yes, definitely some sort of container that it can be transported in would be helpful.
Probably necessary, I would guess.
Yeah, it would need to be a container that to be transported in, but that it may need to stay in for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And just to make sure we want to try to help all animals find a new home. I think that our focus is a little bit more on the, you know, the fish tanks and the the not your usual just cat and dog for this event.
Okay. So the more exotic or...
The more exotic, the things that you may really be struggling with what to do with it. I think it's a pretty easy thing to call the pound or the animal shelter for a cat or a dog.
And I think a lot of folks do automatically go to that option.
Okay.
But certainly if someone comes with... a dog or a cat, we are not going to send them away.
Right.
We are going to make sure that we find an option for them. But as Amy mentioned, yes, if folks probably have some sort of container that they are transporting the animal in for other reasons, please bring it in a container so that we can ensure that while it is in transition of getting to an agency, that it's comfortable and it has the amenities that it needs.
So don't worry, folks. There won't be any snapping turtles roaming around.
No.
Rummage rampage.
We definitely have an area where all these can be in their own space, away from all the excitement of rummage rampage.
You can tell I grew up swimming in rivers in Iowa.
You keep coming back to the snapping turtle.
We want to celebrate the excitement of new opportunities, moving to new places, and take away the stress of, oh my goodness, what do I do, with this animal that I might have? And certainly this happens around graduation to our students, but there are other residents in Ames, too, and in the surrounding community that have these challenges.
So how did this conversation come up? This is clearly part of some sort of initiative that came into being.
It started with... when we were finding the invasive plants that most likely came from aquariums, and there are some surrounding states that do have campaigns and events where you can surrender your pet. It's not something that anyone that we're aware of in Iowa is doing currently, or definitely not statewide. So we wanted to try and provide this educational opportunity and a placement for them as well.
Mm-hmm. Marlene, I have a related question that I know we've wondered at home and other people have asked about. This is not quite the same thing, but for instance, when you have a humane trap for a raccoon because he's eating all your tomatoes. So you trap this raccoon and then you take them, 15 miles away and let them out in the woods somewhere. What are you actually doing to that animal? Are you actually creating real hardship by separating them?
Well, by separating them from their home, yes. I mean, a couple of things about that. An animal has their food, water, shelter that they are familiar with in their territory, and so when we remove them to a new place, they're not familiar with that place, and that place is already taken up by other raccoons, and so it will have to duke it out amidst the local population there, which isn't a good thing for any of those animals. The DNR actually doesn't want people to trap and relocate, so what we try and do at the Iowa Wildlife Center is to get people to haze the animal away. It's our responsibility to prevent them from getting at our tomatoes. And so whether it's through fences, getting woodchucks to stop tunneling under your garage or something. And so we teach people how to we give them the tools to deal with it in a way that doesn't remove the animal from its space but allows the animal to make its own decision to move on and find a better place.
Okay, thank you. Well, we've run out of time, and we've been hearing from Mary Rankin, ISU Ames Sustainability Director, and Marlene Ehrsman and Amy Yoakum. And Amy's from Story County Conservation, and Marlene is from Iowa Wildlife Center. And they've been talking about rehoming pets, not recycling, but rehoming.
Including
them.
Snails, by golly.
Oh, the snails, yes. Well, thank you for being here. And you've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg. Thank you for listening. And remember that you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.